Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00014. Recorded on January 30th, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Clovis and Butthead. Clovis and Butthead. Chapter 14.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
I'm sitting in the F-150 mobile studio on my break at work, waiting for a series of ice storms to begin. We are looking this week at, it's supposed to be four waves come through over the course of 4 days. And this is winter in Texas, you know. If you get ice at all, that's your winter. It has not been cold, for example, this year. Not really. I think early December, maybe, it dropped down into like the 20s momentarily for a day or two. And but it's been anywhere between like 40 to 80. Consistently all the way through. It's never really been that bad. In fact, this is the first time I broke out my quote-unquote weather gear this year, which consists of, I wear a different pair of boots. I got Western work boots that I call my moon boots. You probably hear me refer to that through time. I use them for riding the Harley, and I use them for winter work, which I have to do here in the job. I'll get into that. But so I got my moon boots on. They're a pair of, what the hell they called, like Justin Commander X's. They were not cheap. They were $175 some years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And I don't know, they're steel tip, square tip. Now, they got a work boot bottom, but it's kind of foamy, like it's real cushiony and comfortable. And I don't think they're insulated, but they are warm. And it used to be like when I was growing up, I wore work boots all the time and usually steel tips. And in the winter time, you had steel tips on. It's like the steel in them. Now, they make this shit out of a composite, so that may be the difference. But I remember steel tips, the steel in the tip of a boot would actually be cold. It would make your toes fucking colder, right? And, you know, when you're little kids, you used to, like, double up and triple up on socks. I don't. I wear these things with one pair of socks, and I don't care if it's 2 degrees above zero outside. It's tested and tried. I've never had a problem with it, you know? This is how I gear up. I don't wear long johns, thermal underwear, any of that shit. Just I put these boots on. I throw on a, I got this thick hoodie. It's a Harley hoodie, Harley Davidson hoodie. But it's thick, it's heavy. And then I got a Carhartt, just regular Carhartt canvas jacket insulated with a hood. I mean, it's nothing fancy, but it's like the closest thing to a winter coat that I have. And I've been wearing this for like, what, 16 years, 17 years. I bought it when I was going off to drive the truck. You know, that's just part of my truck driving gear. But, you know, it's held up. And in Texas, I don't wear it, but, you know, 5 to 10 times a year. So it's probably going to last me till I die. And, well, whatever. And then I have a black beanie, just like one of those ordinary wool beanies. I'll throw that on just to cover my bald head and my ears, right? That's it. And a pair of gloves. I got some, like, you know, puffy winter gloves that are work gloves that I use on the job over here. I got another pair at home that are more oriented towards, you know, riding cold weather on a motorcycle. But I've brought them in here, too. They've got, like, the gauntlet-style wrists and everything like that. I don't think there's any need. We're not really like into cold, cold weather here. We're hovering around freezing, and that's why it's a nice situation, right? And this we get it just about every year. Yeah, it hardly snows. It can. It has. The worst I ever saw was 10 years ago, about 2012, 2013, somewhere in there. We got 8 inches one day. 8 inches of snow. And that was like a century event, you know. It never happens like that. If you get snow, it's anywhere from trace to like 2 or 3 inches normally, and usually more like towards trace, you know, unmeasurable to maybe half an inch. We don't get a whole hell of a lot of that there. These last couple of years, we've gotten into some cold snaps, of course. So one of them, what was it, last year, year before, was infamous. You know, the whole country was aware of it. We had a problem with the infrastructure down here keeping up. It got down into like single digits, down to zero, probably a little bit below zero in some places around. And that's just a completely unique phenomenon. That could be millennial, you know, certainly a century. But it could be an event that happens once in even 1,000 years. It was just so crazy. So Texas wasn't built for that, you know. And the infrastructure, you know, 100 years ago, there was no electricity or anything. It built up to the needs of the state, and it makes sense. And when it really got tested with something that was just way out of the ordinary, right? You had some failures. I didn't have a problem with it. Me and my wife, you know, we were high and dry the whole time. We never lost energy or never lost heat, nothing. We were good. But a lot of people did. A lot of people had some hard times during that period. A lot of the problems along the way have supposedly been fixed, you know, shored up, whatever. And the system's not really been taxed. You know, it was more than just getting super cold. It stayed that way for like 10 days in a row. Both of those things are weird. That just doesn't happen. If it gets cold here, it gets cold for, you know, a day, 2, 3 days. It will get down into the teens. Every once in a while, it might get down to like 8 or 9 degrees, like in the deepest, darkest part of the night. When some nasty cold front comes through, it's rare. It's rare, you know. To go down to zero is significantly much rarer than that. This is part of Texas. This is, you know, post-Arlen. This is DFW. This is what you're going to get. You got to expect it, you know. It's not going to be much of a winter. And when something wintry shows up, it's usually going to involve ice. And that's problematic in a lot of ways, right? But it's pretty reliable. You're probably going to get 2 or 3 days out of every year where you got to deal with this shit. And because it's so hit or miss and such a little thing for a short time, you know, we don't gear up for it like you would in Buffalo or Jersey or Dakotas. And, you know, fuck it, you deal with it. Because you put ice on the ground here in Texas, the minute the clouds break and the sun pops through, it's gone. The hot sun this far south, just melts it right away. It doesn't last. You know, as soon as the clouds break, it's fucking over. And, you know, our city and county winter weather approaches to dealing with the situation are really minimalistic. I mean, there's usually a couple of plows around, but there's not usually anything to actually plow. There's some sand spreaders, and they're used like on intersections, overpasses, you know, places that are notorious for getting slick, or they just wait till it even happens around here. As soon as like there's a collision, you know, all right, you know, the city will roll out a crew of guys and they'll throw down some sand. It gets like that way. Where that shit happens is notorious. By now, they should know, you know, exactly when and where to throw their stuff down. But it's not like where I grew up in New Jersey, you just rock salt at everything. Oh, here comes some winter weather. You get out a couple hours ahead of it. You rock salt everything, and it keeps the roads, right? And when you get those storms that just outdo the rock salt, or you get areas that just don't get treated, shit piles up and the plows come out, you know. And then people up there, you grow up with it, you live with it. I mean, winter comes in November. You don't wait till December. Winter happens in November up there, and it lasts all the way up, you know, well into March, sometimes into April. And it's an everyday thing. It gets cold and dark, and it just stays that way. You know, it's a dismal place to live. Every place you are in the winter is dismal, right? When the leaves are off the trees and shit like that. But, you know, the Rust Belt and the Northeast, that's in the wintertime, it's like quadruple dismal. I don't even want to get into that. That's not even part of the point of it. But here I am sitting, waiting for the first wave of this sequence of ice storms to come rolling through. And it changes things, right? It changes how I dress. And then my work responsibilities change, right? I do the building maintenance over here. And part of my role is to make sure that there's clear walkways, you know, safe, clear walkways for people to get down, move about without killing themselves. And this line of business, you know, a lot of our customer base early in the days are old timers. You know, the old people get up and they're out and about early, and you know, you got to keep in mind with them. And so it's on me. And what I got to do, you know, my first line is just everything I learned growing up in the Northeast, basically, is get out ahead of it. You know it's coming, you get the rock salt down. We don't use rock salt over here. We did in the past. It's been a few years when we had icy weather. I don't even know if it was the bad year. I think it might have been the year before that. We still were using rock salt. I had sacks and, you know, those 50-pound bags of it in my workshop. I threw rock salt everywhere. Now, when that started to, like, wash off, when we started to get the thaw, A lot of it piled up down on this concrete platform, right, out the back of the loading dock, and it ate away the concrete. We had to have concrete people come out there and just, like, tear it all apart and put it back together. So rock salt is really bad. You know, we use this shit now, you know, new age stuff, space age technology. It's a company, ProSource, makes it, but it's kind of a standard now around here anyway. It's this ice melter with CMA, right? CMA. What the hell is CMA? It's calcium magnesium acetate. And the upside about using this is it's not so corrosive. So corrosion is a problem you get, like I described, it'll eat away concrete if you just let it sit there, right? And that's a lot of the problems that you have with the roads up around New York City. Obviously, there's going to be like old bridges, I think, like MacArthur Highway, right? Newark, crossing over into the airport. You had that old bridge. Everything was all made out of concrete. Now, everything in DFW here is concrete. It's like the concrete fucking jungle here. Up there, it's a lot more asphalt, but you have some concrete things. Yeah, it tears the road. It probably tears up the asphalt too. You know, and the change in temperature starts to break the roads apart up there. And then, of course, you've got the massive amounts of high volume traffic, and a lot of that is commercial transportation, trucks, you know, so you got all the weight differences and everything. The roads were all tore up there. They're horrible. Down here, everything is smooth, you know. It's easy to drive around down here, but up there, not so much. So the advantage with this CMA ice melter is you don't get that corrosive effect. The corrosive effect, you know, it's even more. Here's another thing that's great about Texas that sucks about living up north. You know, when you're using rock salt on shit, you get that corrosive effect. Not only does it destroy the roads, but it gets up on the undercarriage of your vehicle. And it eats away at that. It rusts away at that. You know, the lifespan of a car up there, my experience was you get up around like 85,000 miles and your shit's all falling apart, you know? And what's 85,000 miles? You're averaging, what, between 10,000 and 15,000 miles a year. You basically have a car or truck or whatever that as soon as you pay it off, it's worthless, right? You got to get rid of it and get into something else. Where down here, like on the plains, maybe not so much in like coastal areas where you got salt water in the air, you get a little bit of that kind of corrosion. You know, the worst place is the Great Lakes because you get the amount of snowy, the winter weather that they have up there dictates a higher amount of rock salt on the roads and shit. But the difference is like this, you know, like I expressed, your vehicle at 85,000 miles, all kinds of odd shit starts happening. All kinds of rubber and plastic, like dry rots and falls apart. And obviously all the rust, anything that can rust up under there starts flaking off to the point where it gets weak. All kinds of odd shit happens that really shouldn't be happening at that stage of a car's life. You know, down here, you know, in the plains in Texas, away from the coast, you get a truck and you expect to get like 300, 350,000 miles out of it. You know, my last pickup truck I drove for 16 years, but half of the life was New Jersey life, you know, and then the other half of it was down south. I got 150 out of that. There was more to be had, but there was just enough difficulties with that thing from the time I was up north with it. You know, just the odd shit falling apart and everything like that. And there's things that I had to replace 2, 3, 4 times. I got sick of it, of course. So I got this here F-150 instead, and, you know, I expect I'll ride it to its grave also, but it should be 300,000 miles, you know? I should get a lot more out of it. That's my expectation, but that depends on this truck too, you know? So it's a 2018. Are they any good? I don't know. We'll see. So my work responsibilities, they change with this kind of quote-unquote emergency situation. I got to make sure that people can walk around, that the people, you know, it's a transportation operation. Everybody's able to get their vehicles loaded up and out of here without slipping and breaking their ass. So I got all the walkways got to get this ice melt on them. And then even parking lots, you know, I got to get out there sometimes with ice pick and shit. This is probably the most laborious work that I do in the course of a year. I don't really look forward to it. It kind of sucks for me. But here it comes, right? Here it comes. Getting tiny little specks on the windshield now. It's out there waiting to start. And, but this ice melt, right? This shit with the CMA in it, it's blue. Right? It's this blue ice melt. So when I throw it down, you get like, instead of the yellow brick road, you get like the blue fucking meth road. It looks like, you know, somebody just came out of Breaking Bad and just started throwing blue meth all over the place. It's funny. You know, Breaking Bad was a TV series that ran. When the hell did that run? I don't know. I didn't even see it until, like, I didn't even know about it until it was, like, in its fourth season. You know, I was able to binge watch the first three, four seasons of it, and then I had to wait for the rest to roll out. What was that, like, 2010, 2011? I don't even know. I don't even know the years that it actually ran in production. But, man, I liked that show a lot, you know, Breaking Bad. It took place in New Mexico, right? It was Albuquerque, New Mexico. It was a story about, what was it, Walter White was a science teacher who got lung cancer. He was going to die. He wanted to provide for his family. But, you know, his job as a high school teacher was paying nominally, and he thought with his skills in chemistry that he could come up with something else. And he schemed together with some punk-ass kid that used to be a student of his who was a meth dealer around town to start making meth and selling meth. And Walter was White's idea was to try to get $1 million or more, you know, to leave it for his family when he dies of cancer. So that was the premise of the movie, the basic premise of the movie. And it was really good. The casting was excellent. The characters were great. The writing was great. Except for one, right? One thing. The guy's wife, Skylar was her name, right? And there's this whole thing. There's this whole thing. If you, like, read about Breaking Bad, and there's this thing about Skylar hate, right? And I have it. I suffer from the Skylar hate, too. She was a misfit character. She was, and I don't know exactly how to describe it. She had a face that's kind of, it reminds me of who, like Courtney Love, right? Something like that, who I don't like. To me, that's just a nasty person. So there's that kind of trigger. She's big. You know, she's larger than Walter White in size. And the character and the way they wrote it for her, she was just like the constant bitch, the bitch, the bitch. It's like you're trying to do this shit for this person, but that person's always such a bitch. And he was doing everything he was doing in secret, and it caused all the conflict. But it's like every time she was in a scene, it was like, ah, there she is again. It sucks. And I've gone through it. I've watched it like 3, 4, 5 times. You know, I sat with my wife, never heard of it. We watched it together. Yeah, it's a great production. You know, outside of The Sopranos, it's like number two, like on the to me, the number two television series like ever made, right? Although, I've got to say, its spinoff, based on the lawyer character, Better Call Saul, right? Saul Goodman. I actually like better. There's a season of it out there that hasn't come down onto Netflix or wherever the hell they play it, AMC. I don't know. I don't even know where to find it right now. But I watched like the first three seasons of it. I thought it was, it's the same show, done in the same way, with the same people, a lot of same characters, a couple new ones. I like it better because there's nobody in there that I actually really hate, you know? It's just, there's nobody that ruins it. There's no scenes that are just like, oh, here we go, get like the Skylar. And, you know, but Skylar hates it. It's not just me. It's like, it's a common thing. And it's sad, you know? It's sad that there's a woman out there who's an actress who's like linked to that. And I don't remember her name, but she's such a sweet person. And oh, well. That the main character is the Walter White guy. He takes up this name. I can't even remember. I can't believe I can't remember. Something with the printer. Heisenberg, right? Like the Heisenberg printing press or some scientist or whatever like that. He goes, you know, his little outlaw name was Heisenberg, and he wore this little black, like, pork pie Stetson hat and, you know, black glasses, and he had a goatee and a shaved head, and actually kind of looked ridiculous, you know. It didn't look like imposing or anything like that, but that was just the way he rolled, right? Of course, those hats are made right in my town. There's Stetson's over there. Walter White, you know, I seen something, and I talk about this. I mention it periodically, like the personality types. I'm the INTJ on the Briggs-Myers temperament chart. And Walter White is one of those fictional characters that exemplify that particular personality or temperament type. So I've got like a connection with this dude. There's something about me. Like, I could have been a chemist / Albuquerque meth cook / criminal drug dealer, right? I could have done that in my life. That was one of my pathways, potentially. Like, if you do like the little occupational test, it probably would have come up that way for me. You know, there would have been like 89%. You know, I would fit that fucking category. You know, there was a part of my life when a little bit into that stuff a long time ago. But anyway, so Walter White, he's the main character. And the student was, what the hell was the student? Jesse Pinkman. He was a guy who brought like the youth and the humor to it. He just had attitude. He was kind of like that little chihuahua that just never quit barking. It was funny. It was great interaction between the two characters. And the interesting thing is the appeal of that show, it wasn't restricted to like the young generation or the old generation. Because of Jesse Pinkman and the shit he did on the streets, a lot of younger people could relate to that. While at the same time, yeah, Walter White and all the family fucking drama and tragedy, and older people could relate to that, you know. So there was something for everybody. It was just a well-composed, well-constructed storyline, I think. And, to me, like, one of my favorite characters in it, talking about the characters, is this real violent criminal called Tuco Salamanca, right? Tuco. He was a beast. He was a mean-spirited and violent, explosive. And to me, I don't know. I find that funny. Now, of course, like, my anger and in my life, the anger issues I've had, I've got a volcanic anger also. So there's probably a little relation there. But this guy's a little bit more. This dude is unhinged, right? He doesn't have a moral compass. Moral compass matters. You know, everybody out there listening in podcast land should be thankful to the Lord Jesus Christ that I found the Lord Jesus Christ, that I have a moral compass, because without one, I would be a Tuco Salamanca. And there would be a wake of death and destruction behind me. Because it would just be a matter of, I don't give a shit for any reason except the law. And if I can get away with it, I would do it. And if I get caught, wherever you put me, somebody else is going to die too. It's just about being violent and not giving a shit, right? To be a beast. But, again, thankfully, I have a moral compass. But this dude, Tuco, did not. And he was so vicious and so mean. You know, it's like, I got a pit bull, right? Henry the pit bull. I talk about it. I love Henry. He's great. I handpicked him out of the litter. I got first dibs on it. He had 7 brothers and sisters. I got to meet his parents, right? The mother, she was nice enough. Like, you know, the suckling, the little puppies and shit just laying in a box. The father was outside. He lived in a cage outside. He was the meanest fucking dog I ever saw in my life. As soon as somebody opened up the door to go out back, he just losing his mind, drool flying all over the place, spittle and like almost like blood coming out of his mouth. He's got his lips pinned back, the teeth are out, he is barking up a storm, he's running like crazy to get at whatever. He's like trying to knock the fucking door over when he knows you're in there trying to get. He, insane, right? A person should not let a dog be that out of fucking control. This is like towards its own owner, too. It's like the only guy on earth that it can even go deal with that dog. He'd eat his own family. Mean. And they're big. He bred these things big. See, my pit bull's American pit bull, right? That's different than the Staffordshire Terrier that's running around that you're more familiar with. Those are kind of shorter, smaller dogs. Mean as fuck, right? And good pets, good animals. But Henry, he's an American pit bull. He's tall. He's got like horse legs. He's big, tall, and you know, he weighs in. He's on the light side now. We got him on a diet. No, because he's getting older. I don't want him to be too heavy as he ages because of the hips and all that shit, right, on dogs. So he's weighing in at like 75 pounds now, but he's normally like 90, 95, right? I got him down to weight a little bit like that just as he's like 10 years old, you know. He's a big dog now. He's getting into the old years of his life. I did it on purpose. I kind of leaned them down a little bit. I'm doing it to myself too, you know. It's not like any kind of cruelty. It's exactly how I'm running my own physical condition going into my golden years, right? Golden. Golden. Where's the fucking gold? I don't see much of that around. So anyway, well, I bring up the pit bull because you know, I'm thinking already, right? The two Chihuahuas, Henry, they're all old. One of them is about to die. She could die any day. She should have been dead 2 years ago. She got heart issues. She just keeps on trucking. The other one, he seems to have these little stroke / seizures every couple of months or so, you know. And you don't know with that dog. He could just drop and be done any time. Those are the two Chihuahuas. The third Chihuahua already died, right? All these dogs are 10 and older. You know, so Henry, you know, the Chihuahuas should live to be like 17, 18. But pit bulls, no. Bigger dogs, no. They usually 12, 13. So Henry's like getting near the end. And my thoughts are I would like to bring another pit bull in. I love the dogs, right? They're just good. You just got to make sure you don't let them be stupid, crazy, violent, and get control of them. I want to bring a puppy in to kind of learn the ropes under Henry, you know? Things like going outside. I don't have to train the dog. I don't have to potty train the dog. The dogs will potty train a new dog. That's how it works when you have multiple dogs in the house. Little thing I learned along the way, you know? A lot easier. Just throw them in with the pack and they start following along. He learns right and wrong from them, you know? So I'm already thinking about it. I'd like to get, you know, the Staffordshire a little shorter. I don't need the big tall guy anymore. Definitely want to get the ears clipped. I always thought people did that because it just makes the dog look really mean, but no. With the pit bulls, they got floppy ears otherwise, and the floppy ears, it actually kind of breeds some kind of like ear problem. Like Henry, like his head will stink. You know, there's ear shit. We got to like clean out of it. It's like black tarish crap. It gets bad. You got to get him like antibacterial medication and like wash his ears out. It's a pain in the ass. He hates it. We hate it. But it's got to be done. You know, and he may be losing his hearing as a result of it. And like I didn't know better at the time. I didn't know better at the time, but now I know. So I want to get a blue, you know, those are the gray ones. They call them blues. And Staffordshire, I want it to be a male and get its ears clipped and start over again. And then I'm going to name him fucking Tuco after Tuco Salamanca. I think it's a perfect name. Of course, I did look it up one time. I'm going to try to do it again right quick right here while we're yakking about it. Tuco, it's a Spanish word. And it meant something that's not exactly mean or ferocious. So that's the problem. Where is it? People with a name, I'm sitting here, like in South American countries, it's used to denote a ragu-like sauce in pasta dishes, right? That's not what I've read before. I'm trying to find something else. I'm just not, you know, there's shit here, but I'm not finding quickly enough. Let's see. A name of uncertain origins and meanings may mean the ugly one or refer to a species of owl or rodent or even derived from the Spanish slang word for terrorist. Origin again, South American, gender boy. So whatever, I guess there's nothing wrong with that. It sort of kind of applies to the situation at hand. So, but that's kind of like the plan I got for the next dog to come along, if fate should have it so. A little blue male pit bull, Staffordshire type, named Tuco, for Tuco Salamanca. And that whole show, like, it involves the cartel, right? Tuco was tied in to the Mexican cartels, and there's a lot of drug trafficking that go up out of Mexico through El Paso and up into Albuquerque, right? And because that's what Walter White is doing, dealing drugs in Albuquerque, they start to kind of knock heads, and he starts to fall into a partnership situation with these cartel people, you know? So the show itself, it deals with the drug trafficking element of the cartel, but it does not get into the human trafficking part. Little suggestion at one point in time, you know, showing about people being brought illegally over the border in the back of a truck. And they had these two, like, twin brothers out of the cartels who were, again, they were like Tuco, except instead of being like raging and loud, they were very calm, cool, collective, but they were all just bloody killers, right? And these guys came up with migrant workers in the back of a truck, you know? So there was a little show of the fact that people are brought over the border out of Mexico into New Mexico. But it was not a focus. And sadly, it wasn't a focus, because what we have going on now down at the border involves shit that the cartel is being allowed to do freely. And the biggest, worst part of that, right? They're talking about the drugs, right? They got that new, I don't remember even what the name of it. There's some fentanyl or something like that. There's some fucking drug out there that's just like killing people and shit. It's just being brought over the border out of Mexico, produced down there and brought in and brought in and brought in. And it's a crisis situation, and powers that be are allowing for it. But the worst part is a human trafficking thing, right? The people trying to sneak into the country, and they're being basically sold into slavery, and they're being sexually abused as payment. And it's just a whole fucking really sick thing going on. And that was not part of Breaking Bad. But if it would have been, it would have kind of exposed it, you know, and made it very real for a lot of people. That by the time that we get to a situation like we're in now, 10 years later, it would be very hard for anybody to turn their back on it and put a blind eye to it, right? But the show, it takes place in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, which I've never made it to. I never got that far west in New Mexico, Albuquerque. I did a website one time for, what was it? Some kind of Presbyterian Church of America, PCA, right? So my boss's buddy was trying to start up a church out there, and I got the project of doing a website for these people. And that's like my only tie to Albuquerque. I don't even know if that church exists or if the website exists or what. I don't even remember what the fucking name of it was. You know, I spent like 2 weeks of my life completely ingrained with that, and I have no recollection other than the fact that it was Albuquerque. Now, I got to do the design, so I was like pulling up pictures, you know, and I was using Albuquerque at the backdrop. They got like the mountain right behind it, and you know, so I got this kind of familiarity between that work and the Breaking Bad TV show. It's like almost like I've been there, but I ain't been there, all right? Albuquerque is south of Santa Fe and north of El Paso. They got, I guess I-25 runs down through there, which I have been on, but up by Denver more, right? In fact, that whole stretch is known as Dead Man's Walk or Dead Man's Journey. There was a Larry McMurtry book that later became a movie called Dead Man's Walk that involved the characters from Lonesome Dove, right? You know, heard of Lonesome Dove. Larry McMurtry was the creator of that whole sequence of stories. Good shit. I read all the books. I watched all the movies. I love that stuff. Done very well. But when they were younger, right? What was it? Augustus McCrae and Captain Call. The hell was his first name? I can't remember. When they were young, like late teens, early 20s, like their first exposure to the life that they were getting into was this journey across West Texas and across New Mexico, going into this place, in towards Santa Fe, as it was, to try to take it over. I don't remember what the impetus was, but you had this kind of pirate guy who was leading like this troop of people. He was going to go and take over Santa Fe, and somehow Gus and Call were involved with that party. And it didn't work. They got beat, and they all got captured, and they were imprisoned, and eventually they were put on a forced march from Santa Fe down to El Paso, right? And that's what the Dead Man's Walk was. And the Dead Man's Walk, it goes, like, down through the White Sands and shit like that, right? Which I've always wanted to do. After I read that book, I had a buddy, and he read it too. And I'm like, dude, we got to go out there and we got to do like at least like a 25-mile section of the Dead Man's Walk, right? Like where the White Sands are. We just got to fucking do it. He's like, yeah, you know, never did. Now I just want to like get on a motorcycle and ride through there and maybe even walk, you know, a little bit of it. But it's a fascinating part of the world to me. And it's like I've been everywhere in this fucking country and I've not been there. You know, I've not been where I really like, you know, where I would like to live. If I could just point to the map, you know, would be like that area up towards like the Four Corners. Somewhere like eastern Arizona, western New Mexico, where the Rockies meet the desert. Somewhere there that actually has like a river running through, right? So there's water to be had. That would be the ultimate to me. And I've never been there. I've never been there. I've been like near the Four Corners. I've been up like on the Utah side up there. I've been in western side of Arizona. And I've been the eastern side of New Mexico. But like where my little fantasy world is, I've not been to. And it's there, you know. It's out there. I like the Southwest. I like the desert. I always have. And if I wanted to go and I could swing it, my wife would go with me too, you know. We talk about this. We talk about it. But that's the Dead Man's Walk. Larry McMurtry. Check it out. If you don't, not a reader, there's a movie, you know, and it's good. It's done well. It's part of the whole Lonesome Dove thing. As far into New Mexico as I did get was Tucumcari, right? Tucumcari, that's way north. It's I-40, old Route 66, right? Tucumcari. It's like an old 50s and 60s kind of town. Like when you think of Route 66, you think of like back in the day when that was like the highway of enterprise. Everybody who was fleeing out of Chicago to go to L.A. Everybody who was fleeing like, you know, those old Dust Bowl stories about the Okies, you know, having to leave their land behind, and they were going out west as migrant farmers to try to start a new life. That whole, what the fuck was it, that John Steinbeck book, I can't believe it's not coming to my mind. I read it, I seen the movie with the Joad family. it probably come to me in a minute or two. It wasn't part of where I was going, but all that, you know, that's the old Route 66 route, and it goes all through there. And Tucumcari is kind of a big stop along the way because it's not a dead town. A lot of these towns died along the way. The interstate came through, right? 66 kind of intertwines with Interstate 40, right? Out all the way out from like the furthest western extent of Virginia across Tennessee and all the way out to, where does it go? Santa Monica, right? In California. That whole fucking, well, that's I-40. Now, old Route 66 went into Oklahoma and then like bent up towards Chicago. But all those Dust Bowl stories and those people traveling west, that's the way they went down. And they would go through all these towns along the way. And when the interstate was made and it joined up with Route 66, it kind of fucked up all those little towns on the side and all the businesses. They weren't on that strip where everybody was traveling. They became sort of like flyover country or pass-by country or whatever you want to call it, you know. So it's all ghost towns, but Tucumcari is not. Tucumcari is very active. It's like a desirable place for people to go. All kinds of motels and hotels, restaurants, bars. You know, when I was there, I just went there for a day. I didn't stay there. Went there, got like a steak dinner somewhere. You had all the bikers out on Harleys and, you know, it's a great place. And what was really neat for somebody like me, because I don't get to see this shit, across from the town, across from the city, across the I-40 and Route 66, they got a butte, just big old fucking butte, just standing out in the middle of nowhere, and it's like the first one you see along the way, and because that's, as far as I got, that's the only one I saw, a butte. It's just, the buttes are like those little flat-topped, like stovepipe hills. They're like, like the little Rocky Mountain that left the herd and like died and got eroded, you know. They're just weird, and I know that they pop up through that area, you know, and up into Colorado and Wyoming. You know, I've seen them up there. It's not that I've never seen them before, but I rarely do, and when I do, it's like, oh, look at that thing, you know. I don't know what to do with it. It wasn't like I can go climb it or anything, but it was just there, and it was cool, and it's like, It was talking to me. It was telling me, like, okay, you've just left all this other shit behind, and now you're going into something kind of unique and special. So I got to the gateway of all that, but that's as far as I got. I didn't go. If you continue westward, you end up in Albuquerque, and then you're at the Rocky Mountains, right? North of that, Santa Fe. So I got to Tucumcari, but when I got there, like I said, it was kind of like a day trip thing. I was actually staying in some ghost town that had a couple of living establishments. There was a little motel there that was run by a couple of people from England. It just seemed really out of place. I don't remember what the name of the motel, probably just the name of the town. The town was San Hon, right? San Hon. And Hon is spelled J-O-N, like John. San Hon. It was probably the San Hon Motel, but there was like that, like a 7-Eleven, some mechanic, you know, there was a town there, and there were a couple, like, there were people living in it, but there wasn't a whole lot of enterprise. But I found it on the internet somehow. It was part of this whole big trip that I did. I set up, it was cool too. It was like this ghost town fucking trip, leaving DFW and going all the way out up into, like, you know, old Route 66 in New Mexico and back, you know. Really good idea, and it was a good road trip. It was a good road trip. I did that years ago. Well, we stayed in that San Hon, which was just like on the outskirts of where the Llano Estacado drops off. That's the Llano Estacado. I'll get into that in a minute, but that's an escarpment. You know, you got this sequence of cliffs where Texas ends, you know, where the Texas Panhandle ends, and then you into like this desert, like this northern kind of coldish desert of New Mexico right there. So, and all along the way, you know, San Juan was an old Route 66 town, and I-40 runs through it. And then as you go down, you know, you could follow Route 66, but it kind of gets cut off in a lot of places. It's not maintained, so there's a lot of big potholes, beer bottles and whiskey bottles. You know, you can't, like, cruise it. You got to cruise on the freeway and turn off where there's somewhere to turn off. And you'll have these exits, and they got, like, you know, closed down gas stations, abandoned houses, and they're all over up there, right? It's just, it's basically ghost town country. It's like more of a modern era ghost town, not like the old Western saloon outside the fucking tin mine or something like that. These were towns that were very active in those, from the Dust Bowl years up until like the 50s and 60s, until, you know, Eisenhower put together the interstate plan and the interstate finally went through there. Fucked it up for all those little towns. There basically ain't much of anything from Amarillo to Tucumcari. Most everything is has died there, you know? So, that's old Route 60. It's kind of cool, though. It's still kind of cool. It's kind of cool to go kick around and explore up there. But that's all like the Dust Bowl country. I mentioned about that. Right? What's it? Grapes of Wrath. I knew that would come back to me. Right? That story, that's the Steinbeck story about a Dust Bowl family out of Oklahoma, right? Okies. But this whole area, what I'm talking about right here, when you're like San Juan, New Mexico, I mentioned Amarillo, you're in the Dust Bowl area. It's like this square from there north into like the southeastern part of Colorado, over into like the southwestern Kansas. It's all not very far, right? These are big size states, but it's kind of like where they all come together. And the Texas Panhandle's right under the Oklahoma Panhandle. And the Oklahoma Panhandle's real small. Just north of that is Kansas, and just west of that is Colorado, and then under that's New Mexico. So you make a square around that, and you're like in Dust Bowl Central right there, right? And that the whole Dust Bowl thing fascinates me. I'm not really sure why. I'll watch documentaries on it periodically. I mentioned that Grapes of Wrath, that story. There's something about that era, everything that was going down, the people in it, how they reacted, that just fascinates me, right? And the truth is, I want to live out there, too. I don't think, like, New Mexico is really going to be feasible for me for a couple of my personal reasons, you know? I think it would be a great backdrop of my life, but then the reality is, well, you're living within a system, right? There's every state has its own way to do things. And New Mexico's all done out of Albuquerque. Albuquerque's all fucked up. It's a very impoverished state. And I don't see it happening, you know? I don't see it happening for me. But West Texas, on the other hand, yeah. It's about the same thing, minus the Rocky Mountains. You know, there is a stretch of them down in the Big Bend area, but there's no means to live by. That's a place you want to live there, you got to show up with a lot of money. You know, you can't find jobs out there. There ain't nothing out there. But up on the Panhandle, you got Amarillo and Lubbock, right? Amarillo and Lubbock. And I got this song on my phone. And I'm like a latecomer to it. Anybody who likes country music, especially in Texas, they all love this guy George Strait, right? He's got all these songs about Texas. He's from Texas. He's very good. Very good singer. I kind of cut off my country music, and I've said this before, at 1979, 1980, you know? The end of the analog era, the beginning of the digital era. And I don't know if I'm right. I don't know what the timing is with George Strait. I mean, he's alive and kicking and still doing his thing. Old dude. But I don't know if he started out in the 70s and kind of bled into the 80s or if he was more the 80s. I don't really know. I haven't really looked into this guy. What I've done is I dabbled with a couple of songs. And one of his, if it's not his most popular, it's his most, it's near, damn near it. It's called Amarillo by Morning. Amarillo by Morning, right? And it's kind of like a laid back, kind of chilled song about a rodeo rider, right? And Amarillo's like the destination for the next place that he's going to ride. He was a bronc buster, I guess, not a bull rider. And I've never done that stuff, but it's, again, it's one of those things like, you know, that's what I want to do when I grow up, even though I'm 55. I still want to grow up and I want to like ride the rodeo. There's a part of me that's just like that. And something about that song, it gives me a sense. And when I hear it now, and I've got this mindset where I'm wanting to move out that away, Amarillo, Lubbock, the Llano Estacado, like I mentioned, right? That's kind of like the song that is riding that undercurrent of my life, you know? It's a really good tune, but unless you're an actual like rodeo cowboy, it's hard to relate to. It's very specifically geared to that kind of person. But I like the song anyway, right? And you know, so Amarillo's up there. That's a potential place for me to move. I might be able to get a job up there from here. Another cool cowboy thing out there, just south of Amarillo, not far at all, a couple miles down the road, Palo Duro Canyon. This is a Grand Canyon. It is the second largest canyon in the whole country, right? And a lot of people never even heard of it. It's in a lot of old cowboy movies and shit, you know. In fact, it was in Lonesome Dove multiple times. Yeah, it's a place where, like, the Indians live, all these Comanches and shit. But I've been there. I've been down in that, and that's fucking cool. Palo Duro Canyon. You wouldn't expect it, you know. It's weird because it's kind of like on this Llano Estacado is what it's called, right? It's a staked plains. The Texas Panhandle is predominantly this, and I mentioned it earlier, this escarpment, right? It's this raised plateau over everything else around it. Now, it's not humongously high or anything like that. It might be 60, 70, maybe 100 foot change in elevation. I don't know. Overall, it might be a little bit more than that, but as you see it, you know when you're driving into it that there it is. You could see like cliffs and hills and shit suddenly appear. And the next thing you know, you're up higher. And if you look back, it's like big sky behind you. You can see everything forever. And it on its own, you know, the Llano Estacado is like flat and desolate. It is fucking flat. There's nothing out there, you know, like no trees. No, it is actual flat. But for the Palo Duro Canyon, which is a big fucking hole, right? I don't know if it's the Red River or something out there. There's some kind of like river sourced in there that had dug all that shit out. You know, and then there's another canyon next to it, which the name of it escapes me. It's not coming to me. It's like right next to it, too. So you got like canyon country right there on the easternmost side of the Texas Panhandle, right on the border with Oklahoma, right? Cool shit. Real cowboy country, like from the cowboy movies. But the rest of it is just this dead, flat nothingness. And it's farmed heavily. You know, once upon a time, you couldn't do it. And what I mean to say, like the story I'm familiar with from when I was a kid, right? Story by James Michener called Centennial. It's really about Colorado, right? The development of Colorado in westward expansion through history. Had a story in it that actually came out of not quite DFW, but a little bit west of DFW, over like by Mineral Wells. It's Palo Pinto County. There's a town called Jacksboro, right? Jacksboro. And there was like a Texas strain of this Colorado story, which was made into a very popular and well-known miniseries in the late 70s with a star-studded cast. And I mean star-studded cast. It was cool. I watched it with my father when I was a little kid. I loved it. And I read the book a couple of times, you know, Centennial. But one of the stories was a cattle drive that started out of Palo Pinto County, Texas, which is just west of Fort Worth and a little bit north, like northwest of Fort Worth. They're probably getting the ice pretty bad right now. Usually what they would do on these cattle drives up north is just shoot straight up north, go up into Kansas. But they were having so many problems with Indians and rustlers that on this particular drive, they were going to take a chance and they were going to go across where the land was the problem and the lack of the water was the problem. Because Denver is a little bit west, they decided they would shoot out west first and then up north and avoid a lot of that bullshit, right? Didn't work out. They caught up with all that bullshit anyway. They had problems with Indians. They had problems with rustlers. And then they had the added problem, so they were going across a desert, basically, and they were calling it the Llano Estacado, the Steak Plains. They were referring to it. There's no rivers that run up there, right? There's no water to be had. And back then, you know, it was arid land. It was a wasteland, just a flat nothingness. It wasn't being farmed. It wasn't farmable. Nobody knew, you know? What has happened since then is... it was discovered that there's aquifer, a humongous aquifer. It goes from like Nebraska down into Texas, called the Ogallala Aquifer. Beneath all that, they started to drill down and make wells. Now they could farm all that land, and they do. And that's like the cotton capital of everywhere. You know, that's what made Texas the cotton king. The ability to farm out there with all the... aquifer water that'll run out eventually, you know, like it's getting depleted as the years go by. And I've been up there, you know, on that ghost town drive, drove all around the Llano Estacado, and it's fascinating, you know. Now it's alive because it's agricultural, it's being farmed and ranched. So you got these small towns all around it, and road highways running through, you know, schools and all that. People live out there, and you know, the towns have a couple of trees planted in them, but it is flat fucking land. In fact, the west of Lubbock, there's a town called Leveland, Level Land. that's what it is. It's fascinating. It's just dead flat, horizon to horizon. And I've been through all that. And when you're driving around out there, especially if it's kind of like a dry season or a dry year, they got all these things called dust devils dancing around, right? They're like mini tornadoes made of dust. I don't know what components come together to create this phenomenon, but you'll see them out there. Just as you're driving down the highway, there'll be one there, one there. I don't think they're dangerous or anything like that, but they're just all over out on the Llano Estacado. Really cool. I don't know how high. They're 50 foot high, maybe. It's not like they're going up into the clouds and shit like that. It's just something that's happening between the air, the dry air and the dust on the ground, and maybe a breeze or something like that that's causing these things. And they just dance wildly. It's fucking cool. It's weird. And you know, that's all around Lubbock, Texas, which is the biggest city out in that area. There's Amarillo and there's Lubbock. Lubbock is the bigger of the two. Lubbock's got a Division I college in it. Texas Tech is out of Lubbock. So everything is kind of built up around that. And so you got a city. You know, you got a city there. It's a small city, but it's a city. It's got all the amenities of a city and culture because of a college, the university. And it's a decent little place, you know. I could probably get the work I need to get up there and move out into the counties where it's all flat, like Levelin, for example, and work in Lubbock, you know. And that's an aspiration that I have. I'm seriously looking at that. It's kind of watching as a couple of things fall into place, and then I might make a move on that. And Lubbock is famous for Buddy Holly, you know, first and foremost. Buddy Holly come from Lubbock. And also Waylon, right? Waylon Jennings, he comes out from that area. He was out in the country. Buddy lived in Lubbock itself, but they were friends. Waylon was working on the radio station, and Buddy Holly was getting his first handful of hits out when he was 18, 19, and Waylon was spinning them on the radio. He was a DJ, right? And those two were buddies, and eventually when Buddy Holly lost his crickets over some kind of dispute, he needed a touring band, and he asked Waylon to come in and play the bass for him. I don't know if you all know this story or not, but they did a winter traveling show, and the story kind of goes like this. Somebody, J.P. Richardson, known as the Big Bopper, was on this tour. It was a whole bunch of these very young, you know, like teenage, early 20s, early rock and roll stars doing this winter tour, and they were riding on this bus that had like no heat, and it was just a miserable situation for these people. You know, if they got to hang out in a town for a day, they'd all have to hustle and do their laundry, but they were wearing the same clothes all the time. And well, the Big Bopper, J.P. Richardson, also a Texan, but down by Houston, Beaumont, Texas, at the southeastern corner over by Louisiana. I've been through there, not to there. He caught the flu, and he was feeling miserable. And it just so happened that Buddy Holly was chartering a plane because he needed to have a day or two to take care of shit like laundry and things like that. So he was going to charter a plane to go up to the next gig, which was like up in North Dakota from wherever they were or something like that. The details elude me right now, but they were way the hell up in the fucking frozen north. And he was going to take him and Waylon, and there was, you know, other people on there, and this Big Bopper guy, sick as he was, he asked Waylon if he would change seats, you know, if he would swap out, if he would stay on the bus and let him fly so he could go and get some rest and maybe see a doctor, shit like that. And Buddy Holly approved of it, so Waylon stayed behind, and that's the famous plane that crashed, right? Killed Buddy Holly, killed the Big Bopper, killed Richie Valens, and that's what the famous song, the Don McLean song from the early 70s, The Day the Music Died, American Pie, was written about. Right? That was the day the music died in his story. And, you know, it was a whole matter of winter conditions, icy conditions, flying into that shit. They had a guy who was like 21 years old, who was the pilot, completely fucked something up. They didn't get far off the ground. They didn't travel like 500 yards or something like that. It was really short. They just got up off the runway and then they were down like that and dead. But it was a real shitty condition. Icy conditions, they'll fuck you up in all kinds of different ways, you know. You got to be very careful. You got to change some things. Like the way you walk, for example. I know when I was a kid, right, up in Martinsville, New Jersey, we had a girl who was my brother's age, my brother a year younger than me, who was like on our school buses and shit like that. We knew her. We knew her on a daily basis. Her mother came out of the house and slipped on ice and fell on the back of her head and dropped dead right there. That's it. Ice. It'll kill you. You can't just go running off half cocked into an icy situation, you know. You got to change the way. You got to walk flat-footed. Make sure both, you know, your front of your foot and back of your foot is on the ground, and as you press off, so there's nothing that can kick out. You know, you got to walk that way on ice to avoid the fall. Right? You got to change the way you drive. First of all, you shouldn't drive at all. Shouldn't drive at all. If it's icy and you can avoid it any which way, you're a stay-at-home mom, a soccer mom, you shouldn't be on a fucking road. You shouldn't be on a road during rush hour, period. But you shouldn't be on the road in that situation. If there's nowhere for you to be that you absolutely positively have to be at, just stay home. Because what happens is we have less cars out on the road. The cars are really the problem. You have ice out there. If, you know, if people give you room enough, there's an allowance for you to slip and slide if you should happen to slip and slide. If you haven't spun out and everything like that, if there's not another car to hit, there's no collision. So if you have a high volume of traffic in these icy conditions, now it's really a treacherous situation, right? If you have to drive in it, you should have at least as a minimum front-wheel drive. Four-wheel drive is better. And if you have four-wheel drive, you want to get wider tires, more rubber on the road. My truck works great in these situations. It's really, really good, you know? The ice I'm expecting around here should probably be kind of patchy. It shouldn't be, like, too thick or anything like that. It should be all right. But, you know, getting around in the ice, whether you're walking, whether you're driving, always the best thing to do is just avoid it completely. And if you have to do it, then you do it slow. You don't want to brake too hard. That's when things go crazy, you know? Drive slow. If you're in a car, keep it at 25. Try to stay off to the right so that people like me can come blow by, because we don't have the same traction issues, right? There are some vehicles that do better than others, so you want to just kind of get the fuck out of the way as much as you can. You want to try to stay to the middle of the road as much as you can do, where there's been more traffic going over the ice, because you'll find more dry patches to get some traction with there. You don't want to have to brake hard. You want to be really careful on any kind of downhill, especially. Just take the whole thing slow. Brake first, hold that slow speed. Never crank the brake down. Don't lock your wheels, because then you'll just slip and slide. And the same thing goes for hard turns. You turn hard and goose it, you're just going to spin, right? Everything has got to be very slow, deliberate, linear, you know? You want to just keep everything as straight as you can do and keep the control that when you brake, you'll actually stop, not slide. That's how you determine what speed is good for you in it. So there's a couple of navigational tips. Someday you may need it. Maybe it'll help you. I grew up north, so I learned alongside of the best, you know. I've had a couple of failings up there when I was early on in my driving career. But I've learned, and I've done well since then. So that's it. That's it. A whole lot of something about nothing. A whole lot of nothing about something. And tune in next time when we'll talk about more bullshit. Adios.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Arlen Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.